Good afternoon. Welcome, State Departments and Veterans Budget Division. It's Tuesday, April 23rd, 2013, about 3:30. Quorum is present. Members, today we're going to hear 10 legacy funding requests. We're going to pass out the handouts with each presenter. And again, I'll reiterate that we're going to ask that the presenters hold their presentations to 5 to 7 minutes, and then we'll open for questions. And if we do that, everybody will do fine, and I think everything will work well. We're going to start out with the Grand Rapids Children's Discovery Museum with Mr. Kelch. And John, you came the longest distance, so that's why you're first. And I see that we have Mr. Miner with him.
Thanks. Yes.
Good. It's good to see you both, and carry on.
I'd like to thank the legislature for supporting our museum 2 years ago. We opened our new facility 10 years ago this summer. We're debt-free. Our building is paid for. $1.2 million was raised privately. So we have a proven track record. We're a regional children's museum. It's kind of misleading to say Grand Rapids. We serve 17 counties. Our core counties are Aiken, Beltrami, Carlton, Cass, Clearwater, Crow Wing, Hubbard, Itasca, Coochiching, and St. Louis. Now, with this last appropriation, we're reaching 7 new counties: Becker, Lake of the Woods, Manoman, Mille Lacs, Morrison, Todd, and Wadena. We've just started to penetrate, get those kids on school buses to come to our museum. We'd like to add another 6 counties after that. So we're asking for funds to continue this outreach on these new counties, that these kids don't get a chance to come to all the wonderful enrichment opportunities here in the cities. They're getting off a bus from Black Duck, and they, you know, they're thrilled. I wish you could see the looks on these kids' faces when they step off the bus for a day at the Children's Museum. I'll just let John Miner say a few things. I do want to just tell you how many schools we've served. Our school service program, in 12 years now, we've reached 180 different schools, 53 different school districts, 77 different communities, and we've had 1,047 class visits. So with a total enrollment of 44,384 kids on buses.
John, Mr. Kelch, would you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Yes, John Kelch, Executive Director, Children's Discovery Museum.
Good, thanks.
Thank you. Here's John Miner.
Mr. Miner, would you do the same and then go ahead?
Right. John Miner from Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Say, when John and I started this project 25 years ago, John had come from Bismarck, North Dakota. He'd graduated from the university, went to New York University, got his master's in museum, and he was head of the Historical Society in Grand Rapids, and we decided to build a children's museum. It was special for a couple of reasons. Number one, as most of you know, the movie The Wizard of Oz, we had an extra thing like Brainerd and Bemidji has Paul Bunyan. Well, we had The Wizard of Oz. And more people have seen The Wizard of Oz than any movie in the world. It's a tremendous movie for kids about a heart, about courage, about a brain. And I say it's been seen by half the people in the world. So we've collected in the last 20 years the largest Wizard of Oz collection in the world for children. And presently, our museum with the artifacts we have, including Abraham Lincoln's carriage, which we purchased about 18 years ago from Christie's in New York, privately. The carriage came up for auction, and it was in 200 movies because it was the only Baroque Civil War carriage in the world. But Abraham Lincoln had owned it, and it was in The Wizard of Oz. And we purchased it because it was in The Wizard of Oz, but I told John, The Wizard of Oz is one thing, Abraham Lincoln is another thing. And without Abraham Lincoln, that's our biggest calling card for the children. They love to come and touch and sit in Abraham Lincoln's carriage. And it is According to the Smithsonian and Hollywood, the most valuable four-wheel vehicle of the 19th century, we have it insured for $5 million. We paid $100,000 for it 20 years ago. So we've collected assets in our museum in addition to the things we have the children do so that we can make them think big. We teach them not to bully. We teach them to respect their parents. We teach them to go to college. We talk to them about colleges. We have student teachers that come there while the children are there. And now all we're trying to do, because our assets are there, is we need to bring more children there. We have the facility. It's there. It's up and running. And we really appreciate your support. And I say we're only an hour and a half from Duluth and about an hour and a half from the mouth of the Mississippi, from the source, hour and a half south of Canada, hour north of Mille Lacs Lake, and that's Grand Rapids. And we've attracted over 551,000 people to come to Grand Rapids to see our facility. And it's one of the greatest advertising things for northern Minnesota. When they come there, we send them to Bemidji. We send them to the Falls. We send them to Duluth. We tell them about the aquarium. We tell them about the museum in Duluth because we're sharing. Minnesota is a sharing thing. And
you
nothing,
send them to Brainerd, too.
We send them to Brainerd, too.
I was waiting.
They can see Paul Bunyan in Brainerd and Bemidji. But I want to tell you a couple things about museums that I think are I found quite interesting.
We got to wrap her up here pretty soon, Mr. Meyer.
Yeah. So. I'll give you one more thing here. I don't even have to tell you about museums, but it's one of the larger. There are more museum visits in the state of Minnesota than there are for the Twins, the Vikings, the Wild, and the Lynx, and the Timberwolves. There are more museum visits per year, twice as many. So it's an interesting thing about museums for kids and what it can mean to children for the future.
Thanks. And so what we're talking about is outreach here.
Outreach.
And funds to, we've just acquired a 3,000-piece Wizard of Oz collection.
Okay.
Funds to construct an exhibit.
Very good. Questions for this green?
Yeah.
Good. Senator Mitz, okay. Very good. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later. Yeah, thanks. Second on the agenda, Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota, Peter Olson.
And we do have a handout that we're going to pass
and
out.
And we have a handout we're passing out right now. But Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Saxhog. You'll be receiving a handout that is will be helpful in terms of describing what the Children's Museum in Southern Minnesota is all about and what an amazing experience it is for children. And as you indicated, we have Peter Olson here who's going to talk about the project and what it's intended to achieve. It's an exciting project in our area. We've had a lot of local commitment and investment in this project. We found a solid permanent home for the Children's Museum. And so what we're here to talk about is how the state can partner with us to accomplish these objectives. With that, I'd like to introduce Peter Olson.
Mr. Olson, identify yourself, please.
My name's Peter Olson. I'm the executive director of the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota. Thank you, Chairman and Senators, for giving us 5 minutes of your time to discuss the legacy funding, which as a museum director is something that is completely unique to Minnesota and such a huge opportunity for creating access to arts, culture, and heritage throughout our entire state. So we appreciate the daunting task you have before you. So I would like to just second everything that the gentleman from Grand Rapids said around the importance of museums and share with you just a briefest background of our situation and where we see we have a real opportunity to increase access to art, culture, and heritage for Minnesotans. So the city of Mankato has donated a pretty amazing permanent facility to us, and we've raised $3 million locally to renovate it. So now we're looking for funding to do the exhibits in the studios and art. So we've received, we're currently about to get our third legacy grant through the Humanities Center to develop all the exhibits and studios that'll be in the permanent museum. So we've had three legacy grants. And so we're in a pretty unique situation to have been able to develop all of our exhibits with the goals of the Arts, Culture, and Heritage Fund in mind. So everything we're doing is about creating access to arts, culture, heritage. Not sure if you're aware of this, but southern Minnesota doesn't have a whole lot of infrastructure to get access to arts, culture, and heritage. We're the largest museum that I know of in southern Minnesota, and we're operating out of a leased temporary space. So when we get to our 20,000-square-foot permanent facility next year, we're really going to be able to bring in people to connect them to rich experiences. So really what we're asking for is we have thanks to the legacy grants we've received, we have fabrication plans for about 11,000 square feet of permanent exhibits and about half an acre worth of outside learning experiences. So some of the things we're looking at doing is having a farmyard where children and their adults are actually hands-on in the soil, learning about the modern practices of agriculture today and what it means to our heritage, what it means to our culture. We're looking at we've changed the name recently to the Back 40, but it's basically the place where you can go and play in nature. That's away from the farm. But you have all this connection to the heritage of the prairie. We're also doing a quarry zone. Southern Minnesota is built off of building on the riches of the land and our natural materials. So really connecting children to what happens in a quarry and what does it mean for our culture? What does it mean for our economy? So we have a lot of interesting ways to engage children around arts, culture, and heritage. What the situation is now that we have is that we are have these fabrication plans in place, but we don't have a legacy funding mechanism to be able to access it. We've searched everywhere, and we haven't found a channel that would support that of legacy funding that would support doing a sort of wow exhibit experience like this. The planning was there through the Humanities Center, but now we're looking to find ways to build the exhibits. So that's basically our request. I'd like to just really reiterate that we do have extensive local support. Greater Mankato Rotary, 100 members, has just signed on to be our make the Children's Museum their signature project. They're donating $100,000 and 100 volunteer hours a month at the Children's Museum. We are currently starting our last planning grant through the Humanities Center to do our cultural alignment planning. So basically, we want to make sure that throughout the museum, we have a really good alignment of an expression, interpretation of the culture of southern Minnesota from pioneers to today, including working with the Dakota community to really make sure that the Dakota story is being told through our exhibit experiences. And so with that, I'll just open it up to questions. And once again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, where is this southern Minnesota Children's Museum going to be located, or is it located at, or is it within the city limits of Mankato, or?
Yep, it is.
Mr. Olson?
Yep. So, Senator, it is the building that the city of Mankato is donating free and clear is in the city center, right downtown, on a 2-acre lot. And it's all on grade. There's no stairs. It's an old bus barn. It was built in the 50s by Blue Earth County to park buses and road equipment in. Today, the city uses it to park their buses, but they're moving up to a new MnDOT facility. So what makes it just really special is the barn itself, the bus barn. It's 11,000 square feet and not one column. So all on grade, you know, totally accessible. So we think it's an absolutely ideal place for the permanent museum.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Olson. So you're trying to do something on the farm, like or have some kind of an exhibit for on the farm, but it wouldn't be like what they have up towards Elk River called the Kelly Farm, where they actually hands-on working out in the fields or working with animals or anything like that.
Mr. Olson.
Yes, Senator. It's going to be... there's going to be three main areas. Inside, there's going to be about a 1,500-square-foot exhibit all about modern agriculture. So how does it work today? What's life like on the farm today? How do the systems of agriculture work? What is this heritage that we have in southern Minnesota and throughout Minnesota connecting you to agriculture? And for example, one of our big supporters in town, Mr. Denny Dotson, is donating this completely restored antique tractor. It was one of the first tractors manufactured to bust up the prairie. And it was actually manufactured in Mankato. So we'll be able to do an exhibit that shows that heritage of not only agriculture innovation, but also manufacturing, and really connect it to people's lives. So then you go outside of this indoor exhibit, and that's where we do more like the Kelly Farm, but in a different way, but where you do get hands-on with planting vegetables, with taking care of animals, with the actual practice of growing up on a farm. And we have a bunch of different ways that we're going to do that, but really with our volunteer corps, like with the Rotary example I mentioned, we're going to have so many people on hand to help mentor and make these activities really come to life for people that it'll be a bit like the Kelly Farm, but it won't be. I can't say it's just like that.
Senator Anderson, I see, having been at Grand Rapids and sensing what Mankato's doing here, these are children's museums, interactive, not interpretive, but not interpretive the way that I think these historic centers are that you're talking about, the Kelly Farm, the Forest History Center, you know. So I think there is a difference, and they each have their place. Chair Metzen.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members, I just want to applaud for your local efforts here, the $3 million. I mean, that's a big contribution from the folks there, and you ought to teach lessons to other groups how to raise money, because that's a phenomenal amount of money toward it. And we always look, as you know, the state does, for partnerships with this whatever entities are out there. But so I think that's a big plus for your effort here.
Good point, Senator Metzen. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'll just mention that the building that the city of Mankato is contributing is the transit facility that's very old. It's made in the 1930s, but it is ideal for this situation. These repurposing activities are occurring a lot in Mankato. The movement of this facility and its activities up to the old MnDOT building that is being repurposed for our Public Works Department includes the functions that, at least our goal, is to have the functions be up at that facility. And there's a request in relationship to that, too, that will be in front of Senator Stump's committee. I just thought I'd mention that right now.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Okay.
Thank you.
Next, we have legacy funding request for the Children's Museum. Mr. Garcia, how are you?
Very well, Senator. Thank you.
Good to see you. Identify yourself and go
Certainly.
Ahead.
My name is.
We've passed out your
materials.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is Michael Garcia. I'm president and CEO of the Duluth Children's Museum. Thank you, Chairman Saxog, members of the committee, for inviting us to be here today to to talk about the amazing investments the legacy commitments have made to the cultural assets of the state of Minnesota. The Duluth Children's Museum was established in 1930 and is, in fact, the fifth oldest children's museum in the country. It is one of very few children's museums that is actually a collections-based museum. What I mean by that is we have over 50,000 cultural artifacts that set us apart from our colleagues in that we have teaching and training materials that came from Duluthians who left their historic content to places that typically would have gone to historical societies and museums of that nature. The Children's Museum of Duluth has, in the last 4 years, through legacy investments, reimagined itself and, in fact, relocated itself out of the historic Union Depot in downtown Duluth. We've moved into West Duluth. We're part of Clyde Park now. We own a building there, which we are raising $3 million for locally, much like my colleague from Mankato, where we will develop and build out a 24,000-square-foot exhibit hall for the Children's Museum of Duluth with a $4,000 science rooftop. Right now, in the interim, we're in a 10,000-square-foot space, 50 feet across the parking lot behind the Heritage Sports Center on 29th Avenue West. We made that move 10 months ago, and since we moved, we have welcomed over 42,000 visitors to the Children's Museum. We have served over 12,000 additional students off-site in places like the Allworth Auditorium, the University of Wisconsin Superior, Fond du Lac Tribal Community College, the College of St. Scholastica, the airport on its grand opening, the new international airport, among many others. The Children's Museum of Duluth, in the first round of the legacy funding, was awarded $500,000 over the biennium in direct state appropriation that was managed by the state of Minnesota. In the second 2 years of the legacy funding, our grants were administered very well by the Minnesota Humanities Center. We have been privileged and pleased to work with Dr. O'Fallon and his staff and his board in making sure that the needs of the museum and the children have been met. We look forward to continued support and partnerships there. The Framework Committee and the Vision Committee for the Legacy Amendment had talked about the importance of this funding creating partnerships. And as I was sitting here preparing today, I was thinking of the partnerships that have stemmed as a direct result of this funding working with the Duluth Children's Museum. We have had deep and meaningful partnerships with the Minnesota Humanities Center, the Minnesota Historical Society to support our collection effort, the Minnesota State Arts Board for artist support, bringing artists to Duluth that otherwise would not have the opportunity to come there, the Minnesota Children's Museum on an exhibit exchange program, the Science Museum of Minnesota through its Science and Technology to Young Audiences called the NISE Network, and the Arrowhead Regional Arts Council for artist support. These have been critical funds, and we are looking to reestablish our relationship and keep the funding with the Minnesota Humanities Center to allow us to focus on the new building. Like my colleague from Mankato, I am looking for a one-time, non-recurring allocation of funds, $400,000 over the biennium, $200,000 of each of 2 years, to allow the Duluth Children's Museum to engage the professional services and design and consultant fees necessary to develop the exhibit program plans for the new museum 50 feet from the one we are in. As I say, these are non-recurring costs. They're very appropriate because they will bring meaningful opportunities and learning opportunities to all the children from the entire state of Minnesota and the region that we serve. As my colleague from Grand Rapids said, regional centers are the places where children come. We serve children from International Falls, from Grand Portage, from all the way up to the Canadian border, and from the southern reaches of our state. Most importantly, we serve through access programs through legacy funds, low-income children through a free access program that allows any child that's living in a household with free and reduced lunches free access to the museum for a year. As a result, over 48% of our membership come from low-income households, and represent over 6,000 children in our region. I'd like to thank you for your support, ask you for your continued support, and be glad to answer any questions about the status of the Children's Museum in Duluth.
Senator Gazulka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, talked about 42,000 visitors in about a year's period or somewhere around there, but what were the visitors that you got on a yearly basis before the legacy dollars were infused?
Chairman Saksok, Senator, in the mixed-use facility at the depot, the management of the depot collected that data, and so we did not have disaggregate data that told us what the Children's Museum received as visitorship. What I would estimate, and it would only be an estimate, is about 34,000 visitors came into the Children's Museum, specifically in the depot. The difference in this is that we are 10 months into operation now with the numbers that I gave you with the 42,000. In our new facility, it was a business move that was made without a business plan, and I'm very proud of that, actually, because nonprofit boards can't always act that nimbly. We did. We were given the opportunity by the Zeppa Foundation in March. We made the decision in April, and we opened in May. And that's relevant because I believe that our visitorship this summer will almost match our annual visitorship to date. All trends are indicating that. We're averaging about 238 people a day right now, with another 500 per week served off-site.
Thank you. And as you mentioned, the Clyde Center is developing into quite an area, particularly for kids, whether they're playing hockey or whatever. It's out there. It's 29th Avenue, is it not?
Yeah. Chairman Saksok, that's correct. We're on 29th Avenue West. We're part of the Heritage Sports Center, which has two ice arenas attached to it that serves the entire region and nation, actually, with competitive hockey. The Vikings saw fit to take one of those two ice sheets and to donate field sport turf, so the same turf the Vikings play on, is in one of the two ice arenas for 5 months out of the year. It was just converted last week. We access that. We're able to program there as well as in our space. And then there's the Dave and Lisa Goldberg Boys and Girls Club located in the center as well. All of that is attached to our building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garcia, I see you have phase one, and this is for phase two. Is there another phase after that?
Mr. Garcia.
Chairman Saksok, Senator, at this time, the Children's Museum is looking at expanding partnerships and relationships with, and this sounds very lofty, but it's under development. We are currently in negotiation with NASA to become the informal education partner for Northern Minnesota. We actually will have astronauts on the space station speaking to children in an overnight in just 3 weeks. NASA hasn't released this information yet, but has given me permission to share it here. And I say that because we are looking at the possibility of expanding and becoming an integrated science center and children's museum on a regional level, not to replace or compete with the experiences in the metro area, but to bring something regionally home. Should that happen, we would be looking at a phase three expansion with one of the businesses that are attached to our permanent building and looking at the ability to bring an aviation and science program in.
Okay, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Garcia, from what I understand, this amount of money and where your request is for design and consulting fees, and that's basically development, exhibit development, design elements, and program framework. How much of this $400,000 that you're asking for will take up the design and consultant fee? How much is needed for those two areas?
Mr. Garcia.
Chairman Saksok, Senator, I would estimate that will be approximately $165,000 of the total. That is an estimate. We haven't gotten firm fees yet, and we have worked very closely with architectural firms and design firms to negotiate and receive in-kind services where possible.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Garcia.
Thank you.
Good, thank you. Next, we have the Great Lakes Aquarium, Duluth, Minnesota. How are you, Mr. Lavoie?
Very fine, Chairman Saxog.
Good to see you.
It's good to see you, too, and thank you for having me. My name's Jack Lavoie. I'm Executive Director of Great Lakes Aquarium in Duluth, Minnesota. Actually, Great Lakes Aquarium is officially known as the Lake Superior Center, doing business as Great Lakes Aquarium. Lake Superior Center was incorporated in 1989, and in 1990, the Minnesota Legislature saw fit to create Lake Superior Center Authority, which is a public corporation charged with an education focus. The Lake Superior Center Authority went about raising money, both state and local and private funds, and built the Great Lakes Aquarium on the shores of Duluth Harbor Basin, which opened on July 29th in the year 2000. Okay. Great Lakes Aquarium we do about $2 million worth of business annually. This year we expect to have about 127,000 visitors. We're the most popular paid visitor attraction in the city of Duluth. We have 20 full-time employees and 7 part-time, 100-plus volunteers. Our mission is to inspire people to explore their connection with Lake Superior and waters of the world. And how do we do that? We do that through a combination of exhibits and specialized programming. Key focus being education. We offer a wide variety of innovative education programs. Over 10,000 youth participate in structured programming every year. We have a couple recent developments that are going to augment our ability to do that even better. We just finished the construction and equipping of an interactive video conferencing center as part of our long-distance learning initiative, and we've begun piloting programming that has originated in Great Lakes Aquarium that is actually given in classrooms literally around the country. A couple Fridays ago, we were shut down via blizzard, yet we were doing programs out in California in a classroom out there. We'd rather done it in person that particular day, I think, but it was adequate. And in addition to that, we have identified 2,500 square feet of unutilized space in the second floor that used to have a catering kitchen, and we are raising $265,000 to turn that into an education center. We're calling the Exploratorium, that consists of 3 classrooms and a teacher resource center that will be tied into this interactive video conferencing. When that's done, that doubles the space available within our building for education, and it opens up 5,000 square feet overlooking the harbor for new exhibit development. We've received a $125,000 grant from Minnesota Power to assist us with that effort, and we have already raised about $74,000 to match that, so we're getting very close to our goal. Over the past 5 years, we've invested over $561,000 in exhibit upgrades and new exhibit development, most of that which we generated ourselves. All the exhibits shown on this slide were designed and built by ourselves in-house. We're asking support from you today for the most exciting new exhibit we've yet undertaken, and that's called Shipwrecks Alive. Rather than focus on the shipwreck incident, which is always interesting and dramatic, we want to focus on what happens after the ship sinks. Now, which animals inhabit this wreck? You know, what's our underwater archaeology? Why are the Great Lakes so great for wreck diving and the like? And to do that, we focused on 3 stories. We're going to tell a freshwater story and 2 saltwater stories. For the freshwater story, we're focusing on the SS America, which floundered in Washington Harbor at Isle Royale on June 7, 1928. It was a major passenger and freight carrier that serviced the communities on the North Shore. Although the vessel is over 100 years old, it's still in pristine condition, as if it were caught in a time capsule. So why? Well, because it's the cool oligotrophic waters of Lake Superior with low nutrient levels that allow it to be preserved this well. And that's indicative around the Great Lakes, which is why they're such a great place for shipwreck diving. For our saltwater vessels, we've got a couple that we've picked. We're looking at ships of antiquity in the Mediterranean Ocean. This one doesn't have a particular name because we don't know their names, but we're going to demonstrate the role ancient ships play in helping archaeologists unlock the keys to our ancient past. This exhibit will consist of an 18-foot tank where guests will climb up onto a platform and view from an elevated deck, giving the illusion of descending onto a wreck site that is being actively explored by underwater archaeologists. Third exhibit is another saltwater exhibit, and there we're focusing on the Truk Lagoon in the Pacific. In fact, the particular vessel we've picked is the San Francisco Maru, which was one of 65 Japanese ships that were sunk over 3 days by American forces during Operation Hailstone in June 1944 at Truk Lagoon. Known as the Ghost Fleet of Truk Lagoon, it's the largest collection of sunken ships in the world. This exhibit will explore the role sunken ships can play as underwater habitat, as coral and other underwater creatures reclaim the lagoon and the wrecks as their home. What is our timeline? We're eager to begin with this project this fall, finish our design, and begin constructing it in the fall, in the winter, and open it up for our, have it ready for opening up for our summer tourist season. The budget is $270,000. We've indicated in this slide as the amount of the infrastructure, the tanks, stuff that would have to be built to create that environment. And then in addition to that, there will be about a $50,000 cost for the animals that we would purchase to populate the environment, another $20,000 in-house labor costs, which we would, of course, provide. So with that, I want to thank you for your time.
Well, Mr. Lavoie, the first thing you probably ought to tell us, because you do have a pretty good location in Duluth. You're between the DEC, the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Complex, and the lakefront. You tell us where you are there.
We're on exit 353 on Highway 35 as you go north, turn right, and we're there just to the right with the DEC being on the left. We're right on the waterfront. It is an excellent location. We've got probably the best views in Duluth, ship traffic and the like.
I just had, and I had one quick question. Do you have anything in the Great Lakes Aquarium about invasive species?
We do. In fact, we just completed it last year. It's a $134,000 exhibit on invasive species. It was funded with a grant we received from the EPA through the Lake Superior or the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. It's a very important exhibit because we are troubled with invasive species in the Great Lakes, and they're also being transported into our inland lakes and here. And so that exhibit focuses on and what people can do to stop their spread. And one of our features that surprises people is goldfish. It's a tremendous invasive people think it's harmless, and they throw it into their
carp.
Right, and it stirs things up.
Good. Other questions? Very good. Thanks for your presentation.
Well, thank you.
Forward
to hearing.
Next, we have the Duluth Zoo. Welcome, Mr. Mahia.
Thank you, Chair Saxhaug, and committee for having me.
You need to identify yourself for the
who table. I am. My name is Sam Maida. I'm the CEO of the Lake Superior Zoological Society. We're a nonprofit that runs the Lake Superior Zoo under agreement with the City of Duluth. I want to thank you for having me here today and having this opportunity to do a presentation. I also want to thank you for the past support. Our zoo has been fortunate to have received legacy funds since the inception of that particular funding mechanism, and we've used it to help us get accredited, which we did in 2011. And the project, the Forest Discovery Zone, is one of those projects that was in that master plan. Another project that was done with the legacy funds was, or is going to be done this year, is the WPA Pavilion. That project was going to start last year, but we had a little bit of rain and it kind of delayed things for a while. Now we got a lot of snow. I still don't know what's happening. Yeah. Anyway, I think I made somebody mad somewhere. Anyway, thanks very much. I just want to, you know, talk about a forest discovery zone. You know, what the heck is a forest discovery zone? I grew up and still live in Norton Park, which is just southwest of the zoo. It's between there and Spirit Mountain and the St. Louis River. And when I was growing up, that was a forest discovery zone. My brothers and friends, we just roamed all over the place, climbed rocks, learned how to climb rocks and trees and build forts and dam up streams and do all kinds of things that we probably shouldn't have back in the day. One of the things I just want to share with you was one day I came across a bunch of beautiful, beautiful flowers. They were so beautiful, I just had to pick them for my mom. So I picked up all of these beautiful flowers. I smalled them, but it seemed like there was hundreds of them. And I brought them home for my mother. And when I brought them in, I said, "Mom, look what I got you." And she says, "Ooh, where'd you find those?" She says, "Oh, up in the woods." She says, "Well, those are trilliums and lady slippers. You know, those are wildflowers. They're protected. You're not supposed to pick those. It's against the law." Well, I was, you know, petrified. So just like, you know, any other kid trying to hide the evidence, I grabbed those flowers, ran out of the house, went up in the woods, dug a hole, and buried them. Now, why was that? Here I had this great classroom out there, this forest discovery zone. I had all of the things out there that I needed, except I didn't have a teacher. There was no instruction. There was no program. I didn't know any better. I was ignorant. If I had had programming, if I would have had some formal education on nature and the things in nature and how to appreciate them, hundreds of wildflowers would not have died in vain that day. The forest discovery zone in the zoo is our attempt to take what we have been given. And we have a beautiful zoo, a beautiful setting for those of you who have not been there. We sit kind of down in a basin, which works okay when the weather's good, and when weather's bad, not so good. But we have this beautiful hillside, rock outcroppings, huge trees, many different kinds of trees. That's one thing I didn't learn when I was up in the woods, is one tree from the other. Some were green and some were brown. But this was an opportunity for us to take this area, to formalize it, to include, to put a fence, I hate to say put a fence around it, but to protect it, we'd have to put a fence and put it inside the zoo boundary rather than being outside of the zoo boundary, and bring all of the elements together that I was missing when I was young. I had a great childhood. I loved running wild up there. When my grandkids come to town they live down here in Richfield, they want to run up in the woods, so I take them up in the woods. They want to discover. They want to learn. They want to understand what's that tree? What kind of tree is that? What kind of rocks are those? I tell them, don't peel the birch bark. Why not? You know, it's an opportunity to instruct them. The bringing all those elements together in the Forest Discovery Zone is going to give us that opportunity to take the zoo visitors to the next level, to bring not just the animals that we have, but to bring nature, the environment, and our formal education program all together in a natural setting, an outdoor classroom that will give us that opportunity to impress upon them. And, you know, children are impressionable, but you've got to give them something that they can identify with. TV screens can show them a lot of things, but when they're actually out there in nature and the sights and the sounds and the smells is when they really will absorb that. So this is what that whole project is about, formalizing that area up above the current deer yards between there and the old DWP tracks, putting some animal exhibits up there. So we have animals for education program, hawks and mammals, etc., to illustrate to the children and adults the connection, the importance of these animals, how they behave. We didn't see too much wildlife when I was growing up because we were too noisy. Well, it'd be the same thing with a lot of kids up in the wooded area. It's going to be hard to attract wildlife unless we have some wildlife there, except for, you know, chipmunks and bugs and some birds. So we need to have some of those there to illustrate and help educate the public about the importance of all of the things, the habitat, the animals, how we live with them, how we can't live without them, how they can't live without us. So that's really what the Forest Discovery Zone is all about, bringing all of those elements together, including some parallel play structures, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with the term, when we grew up, a lot of us, we probably grew up at the playground and they had monkey bars where we'd swing like monkeys. Well, that was parallel play, basically, is learning to swing, traverse logs, climb, tunnels to crawl through, probably a small rope course for them to navigate for the younger people. We're also looking to put a more adult rope course, starting at the pavilion, running across the creek up into the Forest Discovery Zone. And that one would be an exciting thing because you go right past the lion exhibit. So if you step off the rope, even though you won't be in the exhibit, the thought in your mind would be, if I slip off this rope, I'm going to be in the lion exhibit. But it's all in your head. So we're going to take that area and with the help of legacy funds and formalize it in such a way that we're going to get the biggest impact for the visitors when they go into that area. So that's basically what it is. The handout has the costs, estimated budget for that, put together by a local architect. There's a map of the zoo grounds. I just want to point out the dotted black line that runs all around the creek on both sides is actually the formal floodplain for Kingsbury Creek there. You can see this project is definitely up and out of that floodplain.
Sounds good.
I just want to, I know everybody's kind of anxious, been a long day, so I just want to thank everybody for your time and your past support. And if I could answer some questions, I'd be more than happy to do that.
Okay, is there any questions?
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Metzen.
I've asked this question to Senator Solon about 50 times, but I'm going to try somebody from Duluth. You come from St. Paul, South. Texas is south. Duluth is north. Canada is north. Then it's east Duluth and west Duluth. But I got a little diagram drawn here where apparently when you get to Duluth, it kind of goes like this, east and west. But again, Texas is down there. Canada is up there. Duluth is up there. St. Paul is here. And you get up there, it's not north Duluth, they're south. It's east and west.
It's one of the great
All right, you're dismissed.
It's one of the great geographic mysteries of northern Minnesota. We all agree with that. Yeah.
I had that. That's it.
Good project. Good project, Mr. Maida. Thank you very much.
All right,
for
thanks
your
for having me.
Yeah. Okay. Next, we're going to have the Indian Affairs Council. Ms. White, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jolynn White. I'm the Legislative and Grants Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Before you have a whole bunch of handouts, and don't worry, I'm not going to go through all of them, but I did want to point out what they are in case you did want to take a better look at them. there's our feasibility study. Yours is not marked up like mine is. This is a project that we were given legacy funding for in 2009. And we came to the legislature because, as you all are well aware of, is our Dakota and Ojibwe languages are dying. There are very few Dakota speakers left in Minnesota, and there are also very few fluent first speakers of the Ojibwe language. And so instead of throwing money at a problem, we came to the legislature and said, hey, we want to know if it's even possible to revitalize our languages. So we did a feasibility study, and we found that, yes, it's absolutely possible to revitalize our languages, and we were able to come up with how many speakers are out there, kind of what is the scope and sequence of language revitalization, and what is really needed in Minnesota for our tribal nations and also for our urban areas too. So it's very interesting, and so I have that for all of you. I also have a handout that looks at all the guiding principles for the Legacy Fund and how our request falls into all of those as well. And then I also included, it's about 10 pages long, but it's just a history of every grant that we funded with our Dakota and Ojibwe language revitalization money. People are always curious as to what we're funding, so I just gave that to you with their grant amounts and then just a short summary of all the projects. And all of this, of course, is on the Legacy website as well. But what I wanted to spend a bulk of my 5 minutes on was going through our actual request, and that is the packet that looks like this. Just a short history about us. I know we testified in front of you, but we are the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. We are a liaison between the state of Minnesota and the tribal nations of Minnesota. And you all know there are 11 tribes in this state. The next page is just a little chart showing what we have been receiving in the past and what we've been using that money for. There are two main immersion schools in Minnesota. One is in Cass Lake. It's called the Nagani Urban Immersion, the Nagani School. And one is in Minneapolis. It's the Bochoye Nandakitagon Urban Immersion Program. And so we've been given $125,000 as a pass-through for both of those immersion schools. We've also been given $75,000 a year for a work group that is the one that put together the feasibility study. And last year, we also put together a strategic plan. And I've included a page and a half executive summary of that for you. The strategic plan itself is 41 pages, and if you'd like even more reading material, I'm happy to send that out to you as well. And the bulk of what our legacy funding request is for money that we can grant out to those people who are doing the grassroots and the groundwork for Dakota and Ojibwe language revitalization. And last year we were given $550,000 a year to do that as well. And, you know, we come to you with the request to continue the work that we're doing. When I say we, I mean the people of Minnesota, those people who are absolutely dedicated to revitalizing our languages.
Senator Champion, you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so that I'm clear, Ms. White, so you indicated that the Indian Affairs Council has been getting, is it $550,000 each biennium?
Yes, Senator, that's correct.
May I
yes,
follow?
Go ahead.
Just for clarity. So the other councils of color receive $250,000 of legacy funds. Is that right or is that wrong?
Ms. White.
Senator, Mr. Chair, the other three councils, I believe, were given money through the competitive grant through the Humanities Center. I can't speak to whether they were given their own direct appropriation or not.
So just for clarity,
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, so any expansion of your bottom line for this year, so that is possibly supposed to, you know, help with legacy. So are you saying that any additional dollars that you get, that you guys still need $550,000?
Senator and Mr. Chair,
absolutely.
To fully revitalize our languages in Minnesota will cost millions and millions of dollars. So, yes, absolutely, we're asking for more money, and we will continue to come to the Legacy Committee to continue to expand what we're doing for years to come. Funding our request, of course, does not mean that any money is taken away from any other project that any of the other councils are coming forward to. As to my knowledge, I don't know of any project that the other three councils are coming forward with.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
So you indicated that there was $75,000 that was provided before. Was that also paid for by way of legacy funds?
Yeah.
For that feasibility study?
Sure. Senator, Mr. Chair. That $75,000 a year was for a work group, and that work group was made up of volunteers across the state. And the legislation, which is included in the handout I gave you, had 11 specific requests that needed to be fulfilled in that feasibility study. For example, you know, what is out there? How many speakers are out there? We had people from all the 11 tribal nations sitting on this work group, as well as the Department of Education, Higher Education, Historical Society, Board of Teaching, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Bemidji, and anyone who else who wanted to sit on that work group was able to. So that $75,000 was used to pay for expenses for that work group and to pay for a consultant to actually write the feasibility report and the strategic plan.
And lastly, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Champion.
So the $250,000 that you have articulated on the third page of your document, is that a part of or separate from the $550,000?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it is separate.
It's separate?
It is separate.
So then, so
Senator
Mr. Chair.
Champion?
So then really, it's more like $800,000, because if there's a separate $250,000, then there appears to be $550,000. So that's more like $800,000, which is far more than what the other councils are receiving. Would you agree with that or disagree with that?
Senator Champion, Mr. Chair, absolutely. On the top of that page is indicated we received $1.75 million in legacy funds over the last biennium, and that's on the top of the page.
Other questions? Ms. White, had you finished your presentation?
Pretty much. The last two pages were going over the feasibility report and what the legislature, we were directed to do in that feasibility report. And then the last page really outlines in the strategic plan what needs to be done in Minnesota and our strategies to accomplish that. So what we need to do in the next X amount of years is really implement that strategic plan so that we can revitalize our Dakota and Ojibwe languages. I've heard, and we all speak so much about the achievement gap in Minnesota between American Indian students and non-Indian students. And one thing that we know and we learn and we've studied and it's been shown is that if you revitalize the language and the culture of our kids, you will get them to show up in school. They will show up. They will attend because they'll be proud to be in that classroom and to learn about themselves.
Senator Stahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. White, as part of the overall plan, it seems like one of the important things would be is to teach our children, or you know, not only about the culture, but teach them the language. Is that actually going on? I mean, are there some definable numbers of children that are getting some classes?
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. One of the things that I ask in all the grants, as the grant director, is I say, you know, that's great that this is what you're doing, but I need the numbers. And so one thing that many of them, when they have it, is that they'll send me surveys of the kids when they started taking the class or when they came to the immersion camp. You know, what's your level of language proficiency? Do you know what these words are? Can you have a conversation in either Ojibwe and Dakota? And a lot of them can't. But when they're done with the program, with whatever it was funded for, be it an immersion school, be it curriculum, they absolutely can speak a lot more and comprehend a lot more than was done. We are working on getting concrete numbers of absolutely how many people were affected by each, by the grants in total.
And, Mr. Chairman, Ms.
Chair
White, have, and I know it's probably totally different on how you approach the teaching of the Ojibwe language, but have you approached or established some working relationship with, like, some of the language camps and, you know, like...
Concordia?
Concordia is one. I mean, and there's a lot of language teaching going on in our school systems. And I'm not... the first one to admit that I'm not familiar with
exactly how they teach, but we have, literally dozens and dozens of different languages in Minnesota that are taught in schools. Have what kind of a relationship between what you're doing and what is actually going on or has gone on? Are you? I mean, what connections are you making?
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually, Concordia is one of our fundees. We've been funding them for many years. They do a Dakota and an Ojibwe immersion camp. There's an immersion camp down near the Upper Sioux community that we funded. There is Fond du Lac Tribal College does an immersion camp that we have funded as well. So absolutely, immersion is something that we know work. So we do fund the immersion camps and work with them very closely to get involved in what they're doing.
Thank you.
Good. Other questions? Senator Champion?
Mr. Chair, just a couple of questions for clarity. Can you give me a sense of the number of children who participate in the immersion program and any demographics that you might be able to provide?
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it really depends on the grantee itself. I can speak for and I don't speak Dakota, and I will not even try to say the word, but it's a camp down by the Upper Sioux community, and they have between 20 and 35 students that come to that camp, and so that would be one example. When you look at Concordia Language Villages, their camps are a lot larger. It really depends on the demographics of the area, but if you would like an absolute number, I can get that for you. I just don't have that in front of me right now, but I can look through all the grants. And like I said, we do ask for the participation level of every grantee.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Last question, Senator Jamie.
I would appreciate that. So I'm going to make this a compound question, seeing that he said this is my last question, because I think it's important for me to get my information. I'm looking at the last page of your document, and it says that it appears to be a total of $2.8 million. And I thought earlier that you said that through Legacy you all received $1.75 million. So can you help me understand that page? And lastly, I do agree that when a culture really understands its history, its language, and the diversity of that language, that would help, raise esteem, and that raised esteem can help close the achievement gap. And so if that's true, would you agree that if your culture, and you indicated that you don't speak any Dakota or Ojibwe, and this is a language notion, that it would be important for other communities as well to be able to have the same level of exposure and visibility and learning so that they too might raise or close the achievement gap in their area as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Ms. White.
I am Prairie Band Potawatomi. My tribe is in Kansas, so no, I don't. My tribe's not from this state, but I am a very proud American Indian woman. What the first number, the 1.7, that was what we received last biennium, and we absolutely want to increase that funding. If you look at that very last page, it kind of goes over what we are asking for an increase in funding for. We do want to increase the amount of money that we're granting out for our funds. We are never able to fund anyone who is asking for a grant. We can never fund them fully. We get about $600,000 to $700,000 more requested than we are able to grant out because there are so many people doing this work. Another thing we want to expand our funding of is the immersion schools, and that's because more immersion schools are opening. There were only two immersion schools, one Dakota and one Ojibwe, but now there are more that are opening. There's one in Minneapolis that's opening, and then the immersion school on the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe is expanding, and so we want to be able to offer competitive grants to them as well. And so that's a large amount of what we're asking for more money for. Excuse me, to expand that. To answer your second question, absolutely. As I've stated before, if you teach our kids about our language and culture and history, studies show that they will want to be in school because they get to learn about themselves. I don't pretend to be an expert in any other culture, but I would assume that would be true in other cultures as well.
Good. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. White. I appreciate your presentation. Next, I have the Minnesota Humanities Center. And with us, we have Mr. O'Fallon and Ms. Hort. Welcome.
Thank you.
Would you both identify yourself before you speak and go ahead with your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David O'Fallon. I'm the president of the Minnesota Humanities Center, and with me is...
Corinda Horton. I'm a board member for the Minnesota Humanities Center.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Partially in the interests of time, I'd like to do a very brief overview and then move to the issue that compels us to ask for slightly more money for the Minnesota Humanities Center. So you have some materials coming your way, I believe.
I think we have them.
Think you have them?
Yeah.
The direct legacy appropriation to the Minnesota Humanities Center is $325,000 a year for the programs of the Humanities Center. We're going to ask you to increase that appropriation by $100,000 a year to $425,000 specifically to support an emerging program called Veterans Voices, which is emerging as one of the top priorities for our center because we believe it meets a need across the state of Minnesota. The men and women who have served, who are returning from 11 years of war, we do not believe that we can build a great public democracy if we leave these voices out. A core value of the Minnesota Humanities Center is to bring in the voices of those who've been marginalized or left out. So we have done this through creating original literature with our colleagues in the Councils of Color and other communities across the state. We've collaborated, as you've heard, with the Children's Museums in bringing, adding value, if you will, to their work by bringing in literature, the knowledge of the humanities, if you will, to the development of those exhibits. We've been a good partnership in making re-grants in civics education to address issues of democracy and especially looking at communities that did not receive civics education grants before. I cannot believe that the Minnesota Humanities Center should exist unless it addresses real needs for the people in the state of Minnesota. And I think a compelling need, and I'll boil it down to two, we have an incredibly rapidly diversifying population in the state. The center works for discovering the literature, the programs, the civic events that bind us all together. Your handout illustrates some of these. But a top emerging priority driven by veterans has been to discover how we can bring the voice of the veteran more fully into public education and into public life. And this was inspired at my very first board meeting at the center. I've been there a couple of years now by a comment made by board member Corinda Horton, and I'd like to ask her to address that briefly if she would.
Thank you. I'm Corinda Horton. I am a member of the Humanities Center, a board member, but I'm also a veteran of the First Gulf War. I'm also married to a veteran who suffered friendly fire with his group, and so I know what it's like to be married to a veteran and then also be a veteran, and I am the daughter of a veteran. So I definitely understand the armed services in that piece. I actually mentioned to him a few years back when I on the board when I first met him that I was looking at getting my master's in working with PTSD, and that I believed that the humanities really is the core to making a veteran a whole and making the transition from war to peace and also during wartime as well. And that I believe that my husband and I have been able to survive civilization and the whole piece of it because we have the humanities in our life, art, literature, we have civic responsibility. And so I really felt like I wanted to do something more for other people, knowing that we're going to have so many more veterans returning, especially from the state of Minnesota. I'm currently still serving in the military, so I do know that it still exists. Multiple deployments. And so I said to David, I said, I'm looking at going back to school. This is what I want to do. And he says, how can the Humanities Center be a part of this? And I said to him point blank, I said, if you're going to do something with veterans, two things I want from you.
I want you to meet with other veterans organizations because I don't want to reinvent the wheel. There's already wonderful things being done by other veterans organizations. And two, it has to have meaning and purpose because I don't want you to exploit veterans because I do know that that is a piece that sometimes can occur. So as a board member, I feel that the Humanity Center is the right place. As soon as I gave him my two thoughts on this, he went out, we met with the veterans, the commissioner, we met with 35 people who are active leaders in the veterans organizations, started brainstorming, putting together ideas, ways that the Humanity Center can be a part of this. And now they have a project that they're putting together where they're going to honor veterans under 40 that are civically involved. And this will be a great way for us to start this process and figure out exactly what role the Humanities Center is going to play. We work with K through 12, families, children of veterans. I mean, there's so many different things that the Humanities Center can do. And because they know how to do these things, I feel confident that they can do something that's going to have meaning for people in the state of Minnesota and for veterans here.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to point out that keeping an eye on this project, which is driven by veterans, our three veterans sitting over here, they're not testifiers, but I want to point them out if they would. Could they briefly identify themselves to the committee? Would that be all right?
Sure.
Please, Richard.
I'm Richard Leonard. Iraq war veteran.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Tristan Mattis Castillo, I'm chair of the Women Veterans Initiative and 16-year service member.
Good, thank you.
I'm Nancy Davis Ortiz, and I am employed at the Humanity Center. I'm a veteran retired from the Army in 2011.
Thanks, Nancy. Very good.
Mr. Chair, retired Lieutenant Colonel Nancy Davis Ortiz, I might add, and I might also add board member Corinda mentions as suggestions. I tend to hear as do it, so we're on our project with this one. I don't want to overlook the richness of the other programs that we're doing. These provide a statewide solid base. You've got a map in there that shows where we've been across the state. You've also got a page in there that I'm very proud of that shows how we leverage other funds across the state of Minnesota. So this increase in the direct appropriation to the Humanities Center would be, as every other appropriation we look at, seed money, and we'd look for other partners, strategic partners and colleagues and other sponsors who could help this project as it develops. A core value of the center is that every project, whether it's with one of the councils, whether it's with a school district, whether it's with any of the increasingly diverse population of Minnesota, people get to speak in their own voice and tell their own story. This is absolutely true of the Veterans Project. This is not doing something for vets. This is doing something designed and driven by veterans based in the humanities to create, frankly, a stronger state, a stronger democracy.
Thanks, Mr. O'Fallon. It sounds like a great new project. Questions? Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, I just noticed in one of the brochures that one of our former colleagues is listed, former Senator Ted Daley.
Oh, yeah.
And is he on the board as well?
Yes. Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, former Senator Daley's not on the board, but he's made this one of his top personal priorities, and as you might recall, he's West Point 101st Airborne Combat Vet.
That's exactly right. Okay, well, we'll look forward to this next stage of programming for the Humanities Council. Thanks a lot for being here today.
Thank you.
Shorten, you too, yes.
Thank you very much.
Next we have the Arts Board. Ms. Jens, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Sue Jens. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and the echo in this room is always impressive. I'm really pleased to be with you again today, and we appreciate the committee's consideration of our 2014-15 legacy funding request. Either you have a packet from us or it's coming around that has a little more detail. I will only highlight some of the things that are in there, and you can look at that at your leisure if you have any. Pages 2 and 3 give you a little bit of information about the structure and functions of the Arts Board. Just as a reminder from my earlier preview of what we do, we are an executive branch state agency. We were created to stimulate and encourage creation, performance, and appreciation of the arts all across the state of Minnesota. Our principal activity is as a funder, and one of our key relationships is as the fiscal agent for 11 regional arts councils. Each of those are autonomous nonprofit organizations governed by local boards and volunteers. Together, we comprise a statewide system that we think is well-established, citizen-driven, and accountable, and we together serve all 87 counties of the state. In the handout we gave you, we have on page 4 information about the legacy, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund appropriations that we have received since the fund began in 2010. Through the current year, I will point out that the fourth column at the bottom is blank because we're still in fiscal 13, so we don't have final numbers for that. It's not that we're not doing things this year. We just don't have those numbers yet. there are two key things about this set of data that I wanted to point out. One is that all of the grant requests, all of the applications that we and the regional arts councils receive are reviewed through a rigorous competitive process. There is no guaranteed funding. No individual or organization has an ongoing commitment of funding. We review those every year, and they must compete for those dollars. The other thing that I think is important about the numbers is that if you average the total dollars requested year after year, it's approximately $50 million per year in requests. And we're able to fund just over half of those requests. On to the next pages, 5, 6, and 7, we've highlighted some of the things that we have been investing legacy funds in for the past 3 or 4 years. And I won't go into a great deal of detail, but we categorize our funding in the same way that the Constitution talks about the amendment and what it's meant to do. So in arts and arts access, we're trying to build up and strengthen and expand the creative individuals and organizations that call Minnesota home. You know many of them, from the large organizations like the Guthrie Theater and the Minnesota Opera to very small organizations like Juxtaposition Arts or Climb Theater. And we also fund all over the state of Minnesota, Lakeshore Players, St. Francis Music Center, the Rife Arts Council, and others. But the nice thing that legacy funds have done is also to help us bring the arts outside of the traditional arts venue. So we can fund youth development programs like the Boys and Girls Club in Morrison County. We're also funding in places like the Parkview Care Center in Buffalo or the Granite Falls Municipal Manor, a senior living residence. So the money has allowed us to go outside of the places where you normally seek out the arts. In arts education, we are stressing across the system, we are stressing lifelong learning in the arts, whether you're 3 or 93. We want there to be opportunities for you to learn and to expand your own creativity. As I looked at the lists of the grantees and outreach and activities in each of the districts represented around this table, but in fact all across the Senate and all across the state, there are schools, there are community education programs, there are organizations in every one of your districts that is either benefiting directly from grants or from activities or programs that others are being funded to do. Some of the ones that caught my eye: Wadena Deer Creek Elementary, Highview Alternative School, North High School, Fauston Public Schools, Delano Public Schools, and the list goes on and on. At the Regional Arts Council level, we also have a number of councils who provide small grants to very talented young people who want to study with an artist or need a scholarship for some sort of training. And we see that happening in near the northwest corner of Minnesota in places like Argyle and Stephen, and we see it in southern Minnesota and Springfield and Comfrey and Sleepy Eye. So again, all across the state, young people are developing their artistic talents. And in the third category, the arts and cultural heritage, obviously what we use the arts to do is to try to build cultural understanding. As our societies, our state becomes more diverse, arts are one of the ways we can learn to speak a common language and highlight what's the same about us, but also what's unique and different about us. And so we are funding programs that celebrate the original Minnesotans. We've funded some programs, Native American-based arts programs. We have funded some of the first immigrants to Minnesota, like the Roseau Scandinavian Festival or the Twin Cities Polish Festival. And we're also providing funding for the new faces in Minnesota, the Kajug, which is a Somali organization that celebrates the oral traditions in the Somali culture of storytelling and poetry, but they're also getting really interested in spoken word now. As the culture evolves, so too do the arts. The last page of the handout gives you our request for 2014 and 15. And there are some big numbers on there, and I wanted to point those out to you. One of the first big numbers is on the left-hand side. In the first 2 years that the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils received legacy funding, we were able to serve a combined audience of nearly 25 million individuals. When you think about the size of the state of Minnesota, you know that there are a number of people and a number of folks from all ages, all backgrounds, all interests who are being served not just once but possibly two or three times. We're also attracting tourists to come to Minnesota through the arts. The other numbers that are on that page are our requests, our financial requests, and we are hoping for an increase like others have talked about. And we've broken out the three categories and the amounts that we're hoping for. I'm very aware that I'm one person sitting at a table asking you about some very large numbers. In the arts, imagination is a key ingredient. It's really the essence of what we do. So I'm going to ask you to imagine just for a second with me. If you could imagine sitting to my left, the staff members and board members of about 1,000 arts organizations. And then over to the right, if you can think about 10 to 15,000 individuals who work in the arts and seek to make their living as individual artists. Just on the other side of them, probably out into the hallway because we've got a lot of people over here now, we've got hundreds of schools, we've got hundreds of community education programs, and hundreds of community centers who are now providing arts programming or trying to establish partnerships with artists and arts organizations. On the other side of the arts organizations, we have local communities and local nonprofits that are sponsoring arts festivals, summer arts programs in the park for young people, summer concert series in the park. And then here in front would be the thousands of youth development programs, senior centers, healthcare facilities, culturally based organizations that want to explore and expand their arts programming. That's a lot of people. And rather than coming to you directly, they come to us. They come to the Arts Board. They come to the Regional Arts Council that serves their area. You've heard some excellent individual organizations today talking about their programming. You don't have any arts organizations coming to you. You don't have the schools or the community centers or the senior centers or some of the other programs. They come to us. And so that's why our numbers are probably bigger than some of the others. We're the primary way that those programs can access legacy funds to create their work, develop their artistic talents, and deliver their programs. The demand for support is tremendous. I talked about the ratio between requests and grants, but the possibilities are also tremendous. And so we appreciate your consideration, and we hope you'll be able to support our request. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jens. Is there any questions? Thanks for a good presentation.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Yep. The Minnesota Historical Society.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Elliott, Mr. Keller, how are you?
Very well, sir. Thank you. My name is Stephen Elliott. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. And we thank you very much for the opportunity to share the great story of Minnesota history and the Legacy Amendment. We have now had nearly 4 years of experience with the Legacy Amendment, and the results are impressive. I express our appreciation to you, Mr. Chair, for today's hearing and to members of the committee, Senator Cohen, and others who have been involved in helping us to get off to a great start. We've all been given an opportunity by the voters of Minnesota, and with that opportunity comes great responsibility that we deliver results and do so in an accountable and transparent manner. We take this responsibility very seriously, and we've carefully considered and listened to the language in the Constitution, the appropriations language, guidance from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, with whom we consulted early on, guidance from MMB and the Department of Administration's Office of Grants Management, and input from constituents in the history and heritage field, which we put our ear out early on, and we are just now finishing another round of field listening. So today we're pleased to present to you a report detailing expenditures from legacy funds in the current biennium. And rather than go over all of that detail and information, it's in this booklet. But there are a few numbers that represent what the history community has been able to accomplish with history legacy dollars. For example, 87, which is the number of counties to which we've made grants under the Legacy History Grants Program, and 1,000, which is the number of grants made statewide so far. A 100% return on investment. According to the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality, each history legacy dollar spent returns $2 to the state's economy. $2.34 is the cost of history legacy programs for each Minnesotan, less than a gallon of gas or a gallon of milk to preserve our state's history for future generations. 10,000 is the number of teachers who have more resources, tools, and training available thanks to the legacy programs. 3-to-1 is the level of demand for grants based on applications and requests. And so, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, history legacy programs have been a great success. We often get questions about how the legacy funding is used, and so we communicate results in a number of ways. We have a great website that has information available on this report and this very short video, which summarizes the accomplishments of this biennium's legacy projects.
Mr. Chair, David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. We seem to be having technical difficulties over here with the short video that we'll see if we can get it working, and if not, it's available on our website, and we'll find another time to show that to you. The video shows some short highlights of the many projects that Mr. Elliott outlined. I'd like to take a quick moment to look to the future. Mr. Elliott described the projects that have happened in the past, and I'd like to take a second to describe the requests that we are bringing forward to you on behalf of the history community. And I would call your attention to a document that looks like this, that's labeled Minnesota History Coalition. After the legacy amendment passed in 2008, what we did was convened the history community, and there are, just as Ms. Jens described in the arts community, there are hundreds and hundreds of organizations that carry out history work across the state. We convened some town hall meetings and asked what the history community as a group wanted to do. What we came up with was a framework that looks like this on the other handout to create a grants program, or I should say continue a grants program, because we have been operating grants programs since 1969, as well as some statewide programs that are carried out by the Minnesota Historical Society, and a new category of partnerships to encourage organizations to share expertise and resources. That's what the Minnesota History Coalition brought forward in 2009, and that's pretty much what you as a legislature did, and we sincerely appreciate the support that you have provided to our community to do history. The request that we're bringing to you this year is on this sheet, and it's $39 million from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund to carry out the language in the Minnesota Constitution, which says to preserve Minnesota's history. I want to just very, very briefly mention the organizations that are part of the Minnesota History Coalition. Of course, it's the Minnesota Historical Society, but we have a number of partners that work with us to bring history to the 87 counties that have received grants and the 750 organizations. We're joined in the Minnesota History Coalition by the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, the Minnesota Alliance of Local History Museums, the Minnesota Genealogical Society, the Minnesota Archaeological Society, the Minnesota Digital Library, Minnesota's historic Northwest up in Center Stumps area, the Council for Minnesota Archaeology, and the Minnesota History Advocates for Research. So that group of organizations represents all those communities that are doing history. And I guess since technology is not really helping us right now, we're going to go the old-fashioned way and show off some of the work that's been done with legacy funds. And we asked our...
What you're doing, Mr. Keller, may be showing one of the weaknesses that we have and that a different part of our committee has been working on, and that's the infrastructure and IT for the Minnesota Senate.
Mr. Chair, our staff has been spending a lot of time on the Capital Preservation Project, and I know that good technology will be one of the features of a preserved building.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that we've been able to do with legacy funds, one of the many, many things that's outlined in this booklet, is do some acquisition. The constitutional charge is to preserve Minnesota's history. And as we look out at our collections operation, there are sometimes things that we are not able to afford to acquire. And with the help of legacy funds, we were able to acquire this document, which is Charles Speed Holman's pilot's license. And it is signed by Orville Wright. Mr. Holman was the first pilot hired by Northwest Airlines in 1926, and Holman Field in St. Paul is named after him. This document probably would have gone out of state or out of the country had we not been able to acquire it with legacy funds. So this is just a quick snapshot. We'll have this up here for you to take a look at, but just a quick snapshot of what we've been able to do with legacy funds.
Great.
So with that, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for the Historical Society? And how's the, this is a little off the track, but how's the Civil War presentation been going over it?
Mr. Chair, thanks for the reminder. The Civil War exhibit, which was also partially funded with legacy dollars, has been going extremely well. And we remind you that we're having you all come over tonight. Tuesday's our open night, so please come on over and check it out. It's rich with the collections that we've been gathering for 150 years. So thanks for the support.
Are you
for
open
that
Saturday?
Well. Yes.
Okay, good.
It's been very gratifying as the spring break weeks rolled out through the spring, how full the History Center was, parking lot at capacity any number of days because of, I think, that exhibit.
But oh, I'm sure it is.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today.
All right. Good. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Yeah, thank you. Last but not least, legacy funding request from the Civic Coalition.
Good afternoon.
Ms. Bloom and Ms. Warrenburg-Lem.
Yes,
and if you so if anybody's going to present, just if you would identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Tracy Warrenburg-Lem from Kids Voting, and these are my colleagues Jennifer Bloom and Judy Farmer. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and thank you for the previous support from the Legacy Amendment. We are members of the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition, which is a group of individuals and organizations that have worked together for many years to preserve Minnesota's civic heritage by passing along knowledge, traditions, and responsibilities to the next generation. Civic culture does not just happen, it is not a natural state. Sandra Day O'Connor said, "Knowledge of our system of governance and our rights and responsibilities as citizens is not passed along through the gene pool. Each generation of Americans must be taught these basics." The Legacy Amendment was passed to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. Civic culture is shared by all of us. Minnesotans want to continue investing in preserving what matters. It was Minnesota's commitment to strong civic culture that contributed to the passage of this legacy amendment in 2008, and it is this heritage that we must continue to preserve. Minnesotans have been the beneficiaries of a robust civic society from those who came before us. We enjoy a national reputation for our civic culture. For example, in 2012, nearly 76% of eligible Minnesota voters cast a ballot, which was once again the highest in the nation. This is not an accident. In a recent CNN online article, it was stated that Minnesota has consistently high voter turnout with virtually no evidence of unlawful voting and attributed it to, I'm quoting, Minnesota's civic culture. Despite Minnesota's great civic heritage, we believe we are at a critical moment. When Benjamin Franklin emerged from Independence Hall at the close of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in September of 1787, a woman asked him, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And Mr. Franklin, of course, replied, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Keeping our republic involves educating the next generation of citizens about our government. Reaching that next generation of citizens must take place in our homes, in our schools, in our community centers, online, and in neighborhoods across the state. Our coalition is concerned about the following. Civic education is being significantly reduced in classrooms. The current emphasis on math, science, and reading has reduced time for civic education. So this means that the time spent on civic ed must be high quality, it must be engaging, and there must be significant opportunities outside of the classroom. Second is a civic education gap that is growing. Insufficient civic learning opportunities in schools and neighborhoods prevent youth from being adequately prepared for citizenship. And those groups that are most underserved and underrepresented have the lowest levels of civic knowledge. The work of our coalition reaches all students, including those from underserved schools and neighborhoods across Minnesota. Third is technology. Declining resources have created a need for online resources. There is a great need for high-quality civic content delivered to young people in various ways. Increasingly, teachers and others are utilizing the internet for educational materials. Many of these materials on the internet are rife with inaccuracy and bias. Often, the materials are deliberately designed to promote an agenda. Through our 90 years of collective civic education programming experience, the coalition partners have used past legacy funds to deliver programming that is frequently cited as high quality and model programs. I brought a book back there about educating a new generation of civic citizens. The Minnesota Civic Education Coalition creates opportunities for students, we enrich teacher capacities, and we are building statewide networks to scale up these efforts.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Bloom, and I am the director of the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation. And I want to speak with you just a little bit about our accomplishments and about our goals for the next couple of years. We've actually accomplished a lot with a little legacy fund. Over our past 3 years, we've reached 78,000 students from communities all over the state, places like Brainerd, Ely, Albany, the metro area, Thief River Falls, Virginia, just to name a few. Every day, over 100 teachers in the state access lessons from the legacy-funded website called teachingcivics.org. These lessons have been reviewed, they've been vetted, they've been written by Minnesota teachers, they've been designed to connect and align and support the civic standards. They are engaging. They're not the old civics where someone, as you read a chapter and you answer questions, they're engaging their mock trials, their mock legislative committees. Using these lessons, on an average, if we have 100 teachers a day, each teacher in a day reaches 150 students. Over 15,000 students are taught the lessons virtually every day. And imagine the numbers in a semester. By using teachingcivics.org, we're able to reach teachers with high-quality materials. We're able to inform them about programs that are going on in a very cost-effective way. We don't do this by ourselves, although we are sort of very lean and mean organizations. We have very small budgets. We also use hundreds of volunteers. We can say just directly that organizations that are part of the coalition, we involve about 500 volunteers, but that's just in sort of a statewide way. Every community that has Kids Voting or has a mock trial program or has Project Citizen, which is coming here on May 3rd, also has lots of volunteers. So we have very few paid staff people, and we use a lot of volunteers. We are actually requesting for four things, probably add five. First, we'd love to be included in next year's funding. And part of that, we'd like to have some changes. We'd like to make sure that the money is used in the best way. First, in order to make sure that the civic education programs that are funded with Legacy are reaching the need in the need that's most needy among students, and that, and we think, is the sort of the foundations of our system, we encourage the committee to add a definition of civic education. And the definition we're suggesting is on the front page of the handout that we gave you, and it comes from a partnership between the Minnesota Historical Society and the Minnesota Department of Education. And it lays out the very sort of the very basic things. We also suggest that the law limits the money to students, to young people who are 18 years and younger. And you might ask why. We realize there's great civic education need among vast audiences. If you watch the Leno show and you've got questions to the audience and no one understands their basic civic information, we want to hit kids where they are at. So we know that students are in classrooms, they're in organizations like 4-H and Boys State and Girl Scouts, and we've got a captive audience to teach civic education. We also want to teach them before they go to the polls. We know that we have a great habit in Minnesota of going to the polls and voting. We want to make sure when our citizens go to the polls that they've also developed a habit of becoming informed about the issues and the candidates. We are also increasing our requests, and I hear everybody is increasing their requests, and I know that there's a limited pie, but we are asking for more money so that we can make a better effort at reaching the needs of the students. We're small. I said we're lean and mean, but we're just three people on the whole coalition, and we try to coordinate our efforts together. We support each other's work, more money will go a lot further. Kind of connected with that, our first 2 years we were named in the legislation. Our last 2 years it went to competitive grants. And we appreciate sort of the desire to have competitive grants. And we're not afraid of competing for funding in a competitive grants program. Although when the pie is only $250,000 a year, and we are a great number of organizations, we end up kind of competing in a cutthroat way. We're worried about that. This last time, we competed as a coalition. But we think that it's going to erode the coalition. And I have to tell you, for the last 10 years, we've been trying to create this coalition, and I think we're pretty successful at it. If you look around the country, places that have not decided to work together, where there are civic education organizations that have not made the decision that we've made, they have all failed. They've collapsed in sort of the struggle in the funding world these days. And our coalition has gotten stronger, and I got to thank you to the legacy committees and the legislature for supporting us in doing that. But we for every dollar that the legacy committee is spending, we're getting lots more from that via the coalition. So we're hesitant to compete with each other. I mean, once we start competing for audiences and wanting students from Albany to come to my program and not do kids voting, we're worried about what the impact of that is. We also have heard from teachers who said, please don't do that to me. You know, I want to pick the best thing for my kid, and I'd love to have a place where I can call, and I know that if I call Jennifer and Project Citizen isn't the best thing for my students, but kids voting is, that Jennifer will refer me to Tracy, and I'll get the right information. And we worry that if we can, you know, compete for funding, that we won't be supporting each other's efforts that way. I think that's enough of hearing from me. Thank you for your support in the past, and I hope that you'll support us again.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Now, thank you for your presentation, and thanks for what you do. Go ahead,
well,
ma'am.
I should just say it. You wonder, what in the world is she sitting up here
no,
for?
No, that's
she
right. I should have asked you to identify. Go ahead. Identify yourself, yes.
My name is Judy Farmer, and I am president of Kids Voting Minneapolis. I was on the Minneapolis School Board for a long, long time. May have seen some of you in that role. And I was here to lend local color if you needed some additional local color, but I think we've used plenty of time, and it's very late. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mrs. Farmer. We appreciate it. Thank you all. All right. That was kind of a whirlwind tour, committee. We're going to have one more hearing to ratify the second round employee contracts, and that hearing will take place after the Subcommittee on Employee Relations meets one more time and finishes its work, so I can't tell you exactly. I'm hoping that's going to be next week. But our office, back on the subject of legacy, our office is going to be sending out information to you members asking for your suggestions on these legacy and bonding requests. And then we'll be crafting a chair's memo, and I'll send that off to Senators Cohen and Stump. So you'll be hearing from us, and thanks for your attention. With that, the meeting's adjourned.